All the Rage with John Bowd. On www.traxfm.org.
Hello, listeners. Welcome again to All the Rage. And again, I'm very glad to say that I have an interviewee for this week. Please introduce yourself, sir.
Hi, I'm Jamie Woodcock. I'm a researcher and an organizer. And my research focuses on work, and I help to edit a journal on work and workers' struggles called Notes from Below.
Lovely. So we are going to discuss quite a bit of your written work this evening, quite a bit of your organising work, but also we're going to discuss what I think you've done really well is shine a light, if that's not too cliched a phrase, on certain areas where trade unions, working conditions, etc., things like that, can tend to be ignored in the wider context. Would you agree with that summing up, or am I totally wrong?
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely one of the things I try and do. I mean, I think, you know, work is a topic that's kind of come back into things people want to talk about, and I think it opens up so many questions about what work means today and how people can still try and change work, whether through unions or worker networks or whatever it is.
Okay. Nice one. So let's spin back a bit, and the first thing we'll cover is some of your work you did in call centres. So this was what led to a book called Working the Phones, and also there was a Jacobin article that I saw, an interview with you from 2017, which was regarding that book, and also a very good YouTube video, but we'll mention a lot of that to the listeners at the end so they can go and find it out. So during the process of this, you correctly, in my opinion, identified call centres as the epicentre of our modern working world. It's full of exploitation, low security, no unions, no pay, etc. And you also talked about the kind of physical effect that it has on you. Do you think, spinning forward to now from when you did that work, does all of that still stand? Has anything changed, or where are we now with call centres?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of stuff in call centres is still the same. Lots of people still work really precarious, often low-paid call center jobs, and they, you know, if you're selling insurance to people who don't want it, people still hate working in call centers. But I think one of the arguments I've tried to make recently about call centers is that the stuff that's very fashionable to talk about at the moment is like Uber driving, delivering food for Deliveroo, and so on. And I think a lot of the things that are happening in the gig economy, you can trace some of those roots back to management techniques that were tested and refined in call centers. So I think, like, across more and more work today, people feel the pressure of, like, technological surveillance, of having things monitored, you know, down to the second, having electronic records on their performance and so on. And, you know, not just because I wrote a book about it a few years ago, but also because I think that's where those things were tested. I think we can kind of look back to call centers to make sense of some of the newer work today.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, they really are a testing ground, like a lot of places have been, for and the inability to deal with them and to deal with the working conditions there, I think, is absolutely fed into where we are now. And, you know, I am a trade union rep in a very large union, and we've done some good stuff, but I'd also be very open to criticise the union, not least my union, actually, for not being more involved in that particular sector. I think we dropped the ball there, frankly.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think the reason they've been such a good testing ground is because most call centres have no trade union. Yeah. So managers don't have to go through any process of, you know, agreeing new technology or new monitoring techniques. They're just kind of like, organisationally speaking, many of them are like a blank slate where these things can be tested. And if managers tried to test these things in other workplaces, there would be trade union reps who would say, well, hold on a minute. You know, you can't do this without consultation. You know, let's try and figure this out or whatever. And I think, you know, I'm in the book, I'm really hard on some of the trade unions in call centers, because for most call center workers, they have no contact with a call center, a union for call centers or organizers for them. And I think it's because of, you know, there are some examples where trade unions have done well in call centers, but they're few and far between.
Yeah, we didn't really get that that one quick as we should have done. But then the last decade was a funny period of time, and the late 90s, of which we could dedicate entire shows to discussing. Yes. In fact, me and Dave, maybe we'll pencil that one in for the future then. So do you still think, because one of the things you talked about, people's unwillingness to identify as a call centre worker, do you think, or their ability to, because it isn't that kind of a job that's measurable in the same way, do you think that's still true?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I'm always a little bit cautious to say when talking about call centres is I deliberately went and worked in the kind of worst example, which are these like high pressure sales call centres, where the turnover can be like 50% in a month. They're really, really precarious. And there are some call centres, you know, if you're doing inbound work or more technical work, where people can last a bit longer, you know, they might, you know, work there relatively long term. The thing that I think hasn't changed is for lots of young people who, you know, need to find a way to pay rent or they're trying to do something more exciting. You know, everyone I spoke to in the call centre when I worked there was like a musician, an actor, a writer, you know, wanted to do something more exciting. And none of them would have said, I'm a call centre worker. It was something they had to do. And I think, you know, this is becoming true with lots more work today, is that kind of like occupational identity for many people isn't something that they want to build. You know, they do a low paid job because there's no other way to pay their rent, not because they kind of see a long-term future in doing that kind of work.
Yeah, I would argue in a wider context, they have no working class identity in that traditional sense. They might do in other senses.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting about that is, although like no one I worked with identified as a call centre worker, everybody identified as angry about their shitty landlord that hadn't fixed the washing machine or the fridge or charged them too much to live there, or was like annoyed about having to pay so much for transport. So there were like definitely other elements of a like kind of broader working class sense of being exploited under capitalism, but just maybe not seeing the workplace they were at present as being somewhere where they could build kind of like long-term power.
Yeah, exactly. So perhaps kind of reaching out into areas that are not traditionally the working environment. I mean, that does seem to be a bit of a thing, again, being a bit critical of my own side of us. It's very important to organise in the workplace, of course it is. But sometimes there's a bit of an attitude of this is the only place we can organise. And yet that's never been true. This has not even really been true for trade unions. We've often have been involved in wider culture and society, really. So I don't know why that attitude takes place.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one of the things we've kind of seen recently is like lots of people having a kind of return of interest in like what does grassroots organising mean in workplaces? Like how has work changed and how does that change how trade unions operate? And I think it's really good that people are like, you know, if you want to organise workers, that you're interested in how workers change. But I think it's always been key how workers are composed outside of work as well. So like, what are their communities like? Where do people live? How do they relate to other people? You know, how do they relate to the state? These things always shape working class struggle in important ways. And I think, you know, it's important that people return to figuring out how we organise at work, but we also have to figure out how, like, more broadly we're connected across society, because that shapes what kind of action we can take, what kind of forms of organising are successful and so on.
Yeah. During your time here, though, you did, if I'm right about this, you did kind of look about trying to unionise the place, or at least mention the word and see what happened, sort of. Is that right?
Yeah, so there were, you know, partly because I was doing it as an academic project, you know, I had a bit more space to be a bit of a troublemaker, because, you know, I can get another job after being in a call centre and so on. But what was interesting is there was only one person I ever met in the call centre who'd been involved in a trade union, right. And he'd been involved in one of the shop workers' unions and had had a not great experience with them. And I think if you had gone to people in that call centre and said, let's start a trade union, they would have thought you were mad, because, you know, they'd never have had an experience of it. They didn't really know what it would have entailed. But what we started to do is, you know, if you work long enough in a call centre, you start complaining with people about the work during the break. You start complaining about a manager who doesn't give people the right shifts. Like, the kind of problems of work bubble up, you know, in the smoking area, in the pub after work and so on. And so one of the things I did is to then say, well, you know, maybe we should sit down and talk about these things a bit more seriously. And so we started having like a kind of workplace network set of meetings. But the real difficulty with it was the people who were angriest and who wanted to come to the meetings were the people who in 2 weeks' time would just get up in the middle of a call, put their headset down, walk out and never come back. And so turnover is a kind of huge problem. But what I think, you know, I think to kind of be really critical of the successes of it or not, is we didn't ever manage to build anything sustainable in the call center, but lots of people got really excited about the prospect of organizing at work, that you could get one over on your manager, that you could have a bit longer a break or whatever. And I think once someone's had one of those experiences, they can kind of take them to the next low-paid precarious job they go to, cause some more trouble there, build some more experience. And hopefully some of those people that we did that with, you know, went on to cause trouble somewhere else.
Mm, they got the taste for that workplace
hopefully,
power.
Yeah.
And pass it. It's a good drug.
Yeah.
And it's free, kids. It's a free drug. Okay. Just want to clarify something on the undercurrents. Did you go there with the intention of doing this as part of a project? Or were you working a, you know, a crappy job to make money and then thought, oh, I can make something out of this?
So I worked lots of crappy jobs. And this one, basically I started doing a PhD. And what I wanted to do was actually do a project that wasn't just about writing a thesis at the end. So I told my supervisor I wanted to go and work in a call center and try and organize it and then write it up as the PhD. And I think this is a really rare thing to have a supervisor in university turn around and say, yes, you can do that. There are lots of places where you just wouldn't be able to do that kind of thing. So it was part of a kind of a 3-year PhD project. So I was kind of trying to analyze call centers at the same time and then going to work in this call center and kind of trying to put some of it into practice.
What was your personal experience? I mean, how did it physically make you feel, or even mentally actually, when you clocked off work?
So I remember when I launched the book, my housemate came along to the book launch and someone asked me the same question. And I said, oh, you know, it was like difficult doing the work because obviously it was like reading and writing about call centers in the morning and then working. It was like an afternoon evening shift. So like working the call center until like 9 o'clock. And I was like, you know, it was a bit tiring and so on, but you know, it was all right. And my housemate put his hand up and said, you know, that's just not true. Like you stopped using the phone. You stopped calling me. You'd come home looking absolutely exhausted and you'd eat dinner on the sofa and just fall asleep. And it's funny, you kind of forget some of this stuff, but they're like the emotional draining that you get from having to like pretend to be happy and passionate about life insurance for a whole shift. It just totally drains your energy. And it's, you know, for a lot of people, it makes you not want to get on the phone and call people and go for a drink after work or these kinds of things. And I think the way I try and think about it is like the physical tiredness you get from doing a manual job. It's kind of like a mental or emotional tiredness from that kind of heavy lifting of trying to like, you know, do something that, you know, no one wants to buy life insurance. So like trying to make people feel good about buying life insurance is like a really mentally taxing thing to do. It's totally exhausting.
Yeah, it seems such a difficult task too, because as you say, you're starting from a low point of no one wants this shit. Part two, nobody wants to be phoned up and sold this shit. You know, part three, no one wants a very chirpy person on the other end of the phone to phone them up and try and sell them this shit. So it's I can understand that. It sounds like it's actually very, very tough. Years ago, I used to have a job where the phone rang all day in the shop I worked in, and then one result of that was if I was at home and it rang twice on a Sunday, I'd hit the roof, you know.
Disconnect.
I mean,
no one's happy to get that call, you know.
No, exactly. No, they never are. So it must have been. What was your hit rate like? Did you sell any?
So of course I remember my targets because they were drilled into me in every single shift, and my targets were 1.25 sale per hour. You know, this was, you know, over a shift, you know, over a 4-hour shift or whatever, you're meant to be hitting 5 sales. And it's interesting, like, you know, it becomes like a game. And that's the bit that I found the hardest is when you start treating people like a puzzle. and you're like, what am I going to say to this person to make them want to buy life insurance? And a lot of this stuff is like playing on people's relationship with their children or family members or so on. And there was a point where I was like making my targets pretty consistently, and I'd get home from work and just feel super guilty. Because, you know, life insurance is a big commitment. You know, people are paying it out every month, and you were kind of pushing it on people who obviously didn't want it. And so after that, I just stopped being able to do it. I just couldn't be bothered to close the sales. And that's when eventually I got sacked for just not making the targets.
Mm. Yeah, it sounds heavy, I must say. Okay, so one other thing I should do actually before we go on, because you did mention surveillance. Can you just tell us a little bit about what kind of surveillance went on in that job, and of course how this has now spread out to wider society and the world of work?
Yeah, so the surveillance it comes from the fact that the telephone that you make calls on in the call center is connected to a computer. And so it can time every single activity you do to the second. So, you know, the gap between you hanging up and starting the next call is timed. Every break you take is timed to the second. You know, your conversion rates from numbers of calls to numbers of sales. Everything is recorded. So every single phone call I ever made was recorded. And so it's a kind of surveillance that I tried to make this comparison in the book, but it's a bit like working on an assembly line. Mm. And then somebody can call back every single thing you've ever made and check it for errors. And so the surveillance, I think, has a kind of twofold effect. The first is, if they want to sack you, they can just go and listen to enough of your calls that they can find one where you forgot to read out a bit of the legal text, or, you know, you like broke a rule or something.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, it attempts to be this kind of this disciplinary effect that you feel like you're constantly watched. So you start to check your own behavior. Yeah. Because obviously they can't listen to every call you've ever made. And there's not someone listening to you all of the time, but you feel like somebody could be listening the whole time. And that is a kind of paranoia kind of inducing thing of, you know, making sure you're kind of performing the whole time, because what if someone starts listening in? And it's even harder to deal with when customers are telling you, you know, they want you to die and never to call them again and so on. It's not like the easiest context to be feeling like you're under surveillance.
Yeah, I totally understand. And this is what I was talking about, the digital revolution we're talking about. So we represent people in BT as well, Jamie. And we had a similar issue with our field engineers, because it was hard to organise them because they're never in one place. So what we did, we organised via social media, because they were the main bulk of the workforce, and at the time the CW and BT, or the BT union reps, were looking for a pay rise. And what happened, they mobilised them via social media, and it was probably the biggest campaign I've seen on social media. This was about 10 years ago, 8 years ago. And we managed to, or they managed to recruit the field engineers. And they created a massive campaign, something we get into campaigns on social media, and we're able to recruit those field engineers and mobilise. What the industry you're talking about, in my opinion, because it's new to us, my belief is, and I'm not telling anyone that I suck eggs here at all, it's about awareness. If this show can contribute for awareness of what call centre members all go through, because it is something new. Everyone gets the calls. We're not aware of what terms and conditions you guys are under. Now, these companies, I would say, and this is what was found out with BT, is if a company's retention levels are bad, that company's never going to go anywhere. Nowhere. It's not going to succeed. Never. So if I was negotiating on a national basis with them, I would make them very clear, looking at your retention levels, Mr. Call Centre Man, this is terrible. Your company's going to go nowhere. Or do you want us, or do you want people who work for you to buy into it? But again, we're in something new here, Jamie, in that we weren't aware of that. we weren't aware of what you guys go through. I mean, Ed. So what happens is a law that Tony Blair brought in, and it made it illegal for people to sack people on the spot. They've just found a way around that, what you've just said. They've literally found a way around it by just piecing together four or five calls and just selectively dismissing people. It's terrible. Take it away.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think a lot of this stuff is staffed through temp agencies as well. So you end up with this situation where some of the people are on the same contract, some are on different ones. You know, the zero-hour contracts mean you can just be given no work from the future if you're going to cause problems. And I think it's this kind of shift in some workplaces that happens because if there's not a trade union there, there are lots of changes that can happen quite rapidly. And so without workers' power in a workplace, you end up with, like, the balance of power tips so far in favour of management. And I think that's one of the things that we can kind of see with the gig economy happening at the moment as well now, is, like, by making people self-employed, you can kind of strip away, it's like a legal loophole to strip away all of those protections that people might have enjoyed in another kind of job.
Well, I think politically, and I know some people turn off by politics, especially recently, but politically, we've got to pick a political party that represents us, okay? Now, if this political party decides, well, if we get in power, we're going to outlaw zero-hour contracts, there is a European law that says that if me and you sign a contract of employment, they can't put you on a separate terms and conditions. So these are the things politically we could... I mean, it's the digital age. We're finding things out very new, as you quite rightly and quite scaring what you've said, but... look, I'm just saying, it's about organising, it's about getting awareness out there, maybe writing to your local MP in that vicinity and letting them know what's going on. They have to write back to you, and they have to show evidence that they've made some inquiries. Any MP, regardless of what side of the fence you're on, are in a precarious position. It could either go... I don't think any seat's really safe. So at the moment, they're trying to hear everything to gain the extra vote, because every single vote for these clowns means something. So there's stuff that we could do there, you know, just as an idea. So we just managed to stop a delivery office closure by writing to the MP what it means for his constituents. One of them was a Tory MP, and he wrote back and did write to the business secretary and got an answer for us. But again, what they're doing is they're deliberately keeping you guys moving around. You know, they're deliberately keeping you on your toes, and they've got to realise that the top FTSE 44 companies in the UK, if we're really talking pounds and pence, the top 44, yeah, I'd say 44, maybe 48 now, are unionised industries. So a unionised industry is, according to that, what I've just said, it's a successful industry. And so they would probably ask, well, what can you do for us? Well, first of all, our members will buy into the company. They'll stay and support it and try and help it grow. People leaving, nothing happens, nothing works.
Yeah, it's definitely true. I mean, I think the other thing on, like, what can we do to get, like, political representatives to do better is, I think there's all kinds of debates around the Labour Party at the moment, and I think one of the important things, you know, from doing stuff in workplaces and talking to workers in different industries, is we need to think about what are the changes that can be made that are not kind of external regulation that will just change an aspect of the work, but what are the kinds of changes that a more progressive government could bring in that could enable workers to have more power themselves? And one of the things I was really surprised to hear, I'm not a member of the Labour Party, but John McDonnell saying one of the first things he would do if the Labour Party came into power is make secondary action legal again. And that would be a huge change for, like, groups of more organized workers to be able to take action to support other groups of workers would be, you know, that could lead to huge improvements in kind of less organized sectors of the economy.
We'll just come in there. Now, let's be clear on the Labour Party manifesto from 2017. Some of it they're going to take over, and that is an employer charter. So anything over 11, you're entitled to form a trade union. You'll be encouraged to form a trade union. It encourages you to collectively bargain. I know what John McDonnell said. I don't think it's going to happen. But I'll say something about... So they're not going to repeal anything apart from the 2016 Trade Union Act, which means that you've got to get over 50%, and when you get over 50%, you've got to get over 50% of yes. That's going to go. They never really in their manifesto said what you said. But I'll tell you something, Jamie, and let's be very clear here about secondary picketing or unballoted industrial action. No one has ever been prosecuted for it, ever. Ever. I haven't seen it. It's very hard to prove. It's extremely costly. So I could do that tomorrow. We could do that tomorrow. Collectively, we could back each other up. It can happen. Now, in 2003 in Royal Mail, so we're talking about the 1992 Trade Union Act, which stopped secondary picketing, balloted industrial action. In 2003, the second biggest industrial action since the miners' strike was by Royal Mail. And what happened is in Southall, there was a walkout. They moved that mail to Greenford, the walkout there. They then moved that mail to all different parts of the country, and everyone walked out. Not balloted, they walked. Yeah? And we were out for 2 weeks, and no one was... prosecuted. We never had a ballot, and there was secondary picketing en masse. It was just that we were organised. So wherever that mail went from here to Scotland, as soon as it hit the ramp, people would go. So I think the fear factor of it's illegal, you can't do that, you're not allowed to do that, it's the fear factor. But as I said, since 1981, 1988, 1991, 1996, trade union acts that have come in, no one's ever been done for them. No one. The only time we've been done is when the ballots happened because of the 2016 trade union. They watch like a hawk every single vote. Then they'll challenge it. But there's nothing wrong in people just going.
It's almost like the history of trade unions wasn't that they were first illegal and that strikes were never...
It's never illegal to fight for right? terms yeah. and conditions. I know the media will make out that we're going back to the 80s, we're some sort of... hob-booted hooligans. No, that's not true. That's far from it. All the terms and conditions we enjoy, apart from the digital age, which you've mentioned today, and thank you for that, we've seen the remnants of that. We've seen the remnants of bank holidays, the 8-hour day, the 40-hour week, sick pay, maternity pay. All that was done not through any act in the Houses of Parliament. It was just trade unions. And I think we've got to get our heads around how they hide the digital age workforce like yourselves. I think we've got to have that debate. We do have something similar in the CWU, and we have two conferences. We have one for post people, and then we have one for our telecommunications. But when we see those conferences and the amount of reps attending, someone's organised something somewhere. Yeah? Jamie?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this is the point I always try to make about the call centre stuff that I've written is, you know, there are some call centres that are organised, but I think a lot of that stuff comes from legacy organising. So, for example, PCS organise a bunch of call centres where the work was previously done by, you know, a civil servant department or like, you know, the DVLA or something like that. And I think BT does a lot of legacy organizing where call centers have been unionized from the previous workforce and so on. I think the real problem today is greenfield organizing. Is like breaking into new areas of organizing. And, you know, this is where, you know, I do a lot of work with a small union called IWGB.
They're really good. I like them. They're really good.
Yeah, and they've shown that you can do this kind of greenfield organizing. You know, you can organize Uber drivers or delivery riders.
Yeah.
You know,
I think
the risk is how those lessons get shared, hey?
Well, I think the first thing to do is pick a dismissal and then take it to ET. Try the tribunals. You mentioned about the digital allegation. I'll just give you a little hint of the trouble we had with T-Mobile, where they wouldn't let our organ. T-Mobile or Virgin? It was T-Mobile. Sorry.
We had a massive one with Virgin, didn't we?
Yeah. Now, to what happened with T-Mobile? They wouldn't let our organisers in for some reason or another, and then they eventually let us in. And when we went in there, it was all open plan. Yeah. And then they said, right, you can come back next week, and we had to give them a date. And when we came back, they had sectioned off all the bits.
Oops.
So we could only speak to small groups at a time, because they just literally overnight just put little sections in the office. So we could only fit 5 or 6, 7 people, whereas when we first went in, it was open plan, and we were able to, the union reps are really good at speaking collectively to a lot of people. But what they did is, and then the next section, they would be listening to us because they were kind of open plan but sectioned off. Now, why would you do that? How much did that cost? Why would you do that? That is really, and I'm not talking about something from 1970. This was 2015.
But this is the thing, isn't it? The fact that these companies are so reluctant to let union reps in, that they do all these things, shows that, you know, they're still scared of what a union would mean.
Yeah, the union would mean to reward people to that made that company what it is. We're not saying we want to starve that company and give everything to us, but I always say that you, people like you in the industry you're in, make it happen. You make it work. And we businesses have to recognise that. And I'll go back to the top 48 FTSE companies in the UK on the stock market. They're all unionised. Because people will tend to get up in the morning. People will have a sense of purpose, of good terms and conditions give you good workforce. Bad terms and conditions mean you either have a terrible workforce, low morale, low productivity. I spit when I say that. Oh, and your retention levels. So if you look at Sweden, some European companies who are buying other companies, the first thing clever people do is look at their retention levels. That tells you everything about that company. That is your footprint of how that company operates. It's I think that we had a problem here with a cable company in this country. I think they're gone now. They were called something. NTL, that's it, NTL. There was huge amounts of racism there, and when Virgin bought them out, one of the things, I'm not saying Virgin are brilliant, but one of the things Virgin did do is they looked at the retention levels, and when they investigated, and it wasn't made public, when they investigated that company, the amount of racism going on in that company, and they literally smashed it to pieces and then bought it.
Yeah, I'd add to that just quickly to say, one thing that does remind me, and we need to move on, so I won't go on about this, but something else that Jamie, you did write about, and was sabotage on the job. And I'm now thinking that actually one of the best forms of sabotage is to try and organise a union. Because if that's the amount of money that they're going to spend to reorganise their office, just so you can't actually get a union in there, where it seems like we're doing pretty good work to begin with, even before we've got sign-ups, you know?
John, it's as old as dirt. And now they're coming in different guises. HR, which is a huge growing industry in Europe. So we're talking about Madrid. The USA emanated from Madrid, Sweden and Norway. And what it is, it's a little bit like we spoke about, Jamie, before we went on air. what they did with a trade union rep, I won't say his name here, is they took his ability away to negotiate. They took away the other side of the argument. And we call that union avoidance. And it's the most growing industry in the world at the moment, union avoidance. There are companies that are telling industries, if you got a problem with trade union, give us a call. And they charge them millions. And they're being paid millions. It is scary. And you mentioned, I love the actual title for your website, The Invisible Worker. Because your industry, as I said about the fourth industrial revolution or the digital revolution, your industry is, people aren't aware of it, and it is the... And now, when people ring me now, I'm going to think twice. I might actually try and recruit them.
How did you first get involved with that? And just to remind people, The Invisible Worker is a zine put out by Robbie Warren, who's going to be on the show soon. And, so how did you get involved in that?
I've done various things with Robbie. I think it's worth saying that Invisible Worker is definitely Robbie's project. I've just been a contributor to it. So I wrote a few things trying to highlight some of these new changes in work. And then we came along and did a launch event, which is where I met you. I think it's just a really important, we should try and shed light on new forms of work and how work is changing. And I think a lot of these new forms of digital work are some of the most hidden, the things that happen behind the screen. So the stuff that I've written for The Invisible Worker has just been trying to kind of show how much of that hidden work happens behind the screen and what kind of conditions it happens under.
Very important stuff to throw a light on that sort of thing, because I think, as you mentioned there, as you mentioned at that event to launch The Invisible Worker, but also as you've gone on to write about in a couple of your articles, is we overlook this kind of, so much of this kind of work. And we're going to talk about the games industry in a minute, but almost we don't see it as work. And we don't look at things such as people having their wages stolen or working in dangerous conditions or having a hideous lack of control, and that sort of thing. And yet it's this economy that we're increasingly relying on, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the difficulty with it is it's easy to miss. You know, so many of us use the internet and use various bits of software in our daily life, and we don't think about how much work goes into those things, and how those workers relate to people in different ways. And so I think this is what I think is really nice about The Invisible Worker, is to actually try and like give a voice back to some of those workers who do these kinds of things.
Do you think that, because I was taken by something you said when you were out there, you were talking about how you first sort of became aware of this kind of sector, and you said you teach sociology, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and one of your students had graduated with an absolute fuck ton of debt and was now working for Deliveroo, I think it was. Do you think those kind of attacks on the education sector are actually contributing positively as far as employers are concerned to creating a workforce that is more pliable to this kind of work?
So I think, you know, when we look at these kind of new forms of precarious work and the gig economy and so on, I think it's definitely, there's been a huge push from employers to have a more flexible workforce.
Right.
Like with Deliveroo and so on, you can see why they really want a flexible workforce. They don't want to pay for drivers to sit around and chat waiting for deliveries. They just want to pay for an on-demand workforce when they're working. But I think it's only really half of the story. Is I think we can't really understand the growth of these new forms of work without thinking that maybe workers too want more flexible work. You know, people want to fit a job around their life. They want to work at different times. They want to have a bit more, flexibility in their lives. And this is why things like Uber and Deliveroo are so convincing to workers, is they sell you this promise of flexibility. The problem is when you start that job, you find that it's flexibility not on your terms. You know, you can work any time, but if you don't work Friday, Saturday night, you're not going to make enough money to make it worthwhile. So it's this kind of flexibility, I think, has become like a really important buzzword for making sense of this work.
Yeah, it's the false, I think, you get in a lot of capitalism, which is when they'll pick someone who's done quite well one way or another, and they'll be the person who sells it to you as the ultimate freedom, or the, as you said, you know, you can flex up to do this whenever you feel like it. Except, of course, if you're not doing as well, then you have to do it around the clock. You're not going to make enough money to pay your bills otherwise. It's a trick, really. It's a magic trick, which we need to see through. Okay, well, I think that much more to ask about the Invisible Worker. I mean, it was a very... Oh, wait, sorry, I just wanted to say one other thing I want to say about Invisible Worker. Issue 2 is out next month, is that correct?
I think that's right, yeah. And yeah, people should definitely check it out. The first issue was really great.
Okay, so can I ask you now about Notes from Below? This is your website that you're involved in. Or did you found this or co-found it?
Yeah, so we have a kind of editorial collective. It's been running, it started a year ago in January. So it's been running almost a year and a half. But yeah, there's a bunch of us that edit the journal.
And how does this work? Because you it's all online, but you do have issues, don't you? Like issue 1, 2, 3, whatever.
Yeah, so it's online. And really, we publish, broadly speaking, three kinds of things. The whole website is based around this idea of workers' inquiry, that if you want to understand work today, there are already people who know lots about work, and that's people who are doing the work already. And so the idea for the journal is to try and find ways to do small bits of research with workers, to write up their stories, or to get workers to write their own stories, and then profile these on the website. And so we kind of host these little inquiries where people, you know, write about work in various ways. We then have some kind of more theoretical stuff, and we also host a series of workplace bulletins. So these are generally leaflets that people write in a workplace that are distributed around. And we try to share a whole bunch of these to say, you know, this is one thing you can do if you want to organize at work. You can write a bulletin, you can get other people to contribute to it. We kind of theme things around issues just to give a bit of focus. So we've had an issue around workers' inquiry. We've had one around work and technology, one around unions and workers. And then we've had a kind of bunch of smaller ones following on from that.
And are these printable, or are they just, they solely exist online? I suppose, arguably, if you wanted to print an article, you could do that yourself at work if you wanted to.
Totally. A little bit of workplace sabotage. You could use the printer.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we'd love to do hard copy versions. I mean, I guess with the bulletins, we host them as PDFs on the website. Mm. So people can, you know, you can read the bulletin, but if you're in that sector, you know, you can easily print it out because it's already formatted. And we've actually had a bunch of success with some of these. So we ran a university bulletin during our strikes last year, where we had people downloading it in universities kind of across the UK, sharing it on Twitter and so on. Right. And so I guess it's trying to think about, like, new modes of distribution. You know, how can we get things out and get people sharing things and talking and organizing at work?
Yes, I'm just thinking of how that fits in a way with a sort of classic history of pamphleting, and whether they be printable or even just online, of people writing about their experiences or educating people on their rights, and it's sort of drifting around in an almost underground way in a lot of workplaces where, you know, perhaps not too many people want to go and tell the management they've read it, but, you know, when you're having a chat in the canteen or whatever, you might go, oh yeah, did you read that last bulletin?
This is like workplace network stuff, hey? This is why, like, even as I'm an academic and I do most of my work on a computer and I email people, but there's something about having a printed out leaflet that you can give to someone and say, what do you think of this? You know, would you write something for that? You know, having something to kind of, it's like a conversation starter, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. I've talked about this on the show. It's a bit of a joke before with Dave, but I'm generally speaking struggle with a lot of social issues, and I'm not generally the sort of bloke who walks up and talks to people. But since Dave gave me the opportunity of having this radio show, it's a fantastic icebreaker, because now I just walk up and go, do you want to be on my radio show? And it's normally you wouldn't, I would have, you know, in like events like Invisible Work, or I was about would have gone, yeah, good job, and just left very quickly. But now I get to now I actually get to come up and break the ice with this, which is, of course, exactly the intention of this show, is to get this information out to as many people as possible, and to hopefully inspire, you know, workers' struggles to organise and get more power over their own lives.
Yeah, and I think for lots of workers today, you know, if you've never been in a trade union before, talking politics at work is quite a scary thing to do. You know, if you've never had, if you've never had people talking to you about these things, and how do you go up and talk to somebody, and what's the process, and so on. I think a lot of these skills of the labour movement have been lost for lots of people. And I think we see the bulletin as like one way that you can kind of give people some ideas, but you can get people. So one of the things we're very keen to do, so with a bunch of them, you know, we get somebody from the workplace to write something, put it in, get someone from somewhere else, write something, put it in, so people can see their own voices in these things. And that's the kind of thing that people then share, because they want to see their stories about work as part of their organising.
Yeah, and to show that this is what we got out of this job, now I'm able to write something about it and communicate with the world. And who knows where it's going to go? That's the other thing I love about the online world. You know, anyone could be listening or reading or whatever.
I guess it's also saying, like, workers' experiences matter.
Yes,
like,
absolutely.
Even if you have, like, a horribly boring job where you're not paid well and you hate it, like, your experience of work matters. So I guess, you know, that's been the project, really, to say that, like, you know, if you want to be on the left and you want to talk about changing the world and so on, like, that starts from the workplace, and it starts from, you know, those sometimes boring and frustrating experiences that we have at work.
Yeah, completely. I mean, you've just said that far more articulately than I could. I think that's pretty much what I was trying to say. Yeah, you're absolutely correct. It gives a voice to the experiences of people who aren't talked about. I mean, one example reminds me of that from way back is, I've actually got a book about this called Dishwasher by a guy named Pete Jordan. And Pete Jordan used to do his own zine about dishwashing. It's great. It's an interesting book, because in the process of studying, of researching this, he found out about strikes that had taken place from dishwashers and things like this. And of course, you know, he points out that the most important job in anywhere that's serving food is the bloke who cleans all of, or the person, sorry, who cleans all of the cutlery and plates and everything else. Otherwise, you can't serve the food. So he goes through that. And what he did was he started a zine with his own writing, and then started asking other people, what do you think? And he built up these stories and his contacts, to put in his zine, via a project he had to try and clean dishes in every state of the 50 states in America. That was 50 at the time.
Wow.
He didn't quite make it, but he did do some interesting ones. He also did it on a ship once, but I digress. It's called Dishwasher by Pete Jordan. It's a book.
I'll have a look.
Yeah. It's probably kicking. It's not in print now, but it's probably kicking around secondhand somewhere. So yeah, I'd recommend that book. Okay, so let's get a little bit more up to date. Let's get a little bit more today. And a book called Marx in the Arcade, Consoles, Controllers and Class Struggle. Tell me all about it.
So this is a book that it's kind of funny thinking about it now, because, you know, writing about Marxism in video games felt like something, you know, if I had more time, I would love to play more video games. And so it was a kind of, you know, I'm a Marxist, how do I make sense of this? And it's a kind of idea that I've been thinking about on and off for a few years. And then basically there's been the beginning of a wave of organizing in the video games industry. And so it felt like the right time to try and have a critical analysis of the industry and to tie it in with some of these new forms of organizing.
You've done a great job, I think, by shining a light on a sector that that we just don't think about as having issues of work. I mean, I think that maybe I'm wrong about this, because I haven't really played video games for many, many years. But correct me if I'm wrong about this. There seems to be a bit of an idea that they've got away with promoting this idea that maybe an individual or a couple of individuals who are very smart and they understand games have just come up with this idea, be it Grand Theft Auto or whatever, and put it out into the world, and that's it. As if there's no other person involved in that process. It seems like that's happened a little bit. Do you think that's wrong?
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think there's a myth of the British video games industry as being like, these like bedroom companies where someone has a great idea, luckily someone pays them for it, and then suddenly there's this like polished game at the end of it. And I think GTA is a really good example for this. So it's one of the biggest video game series, and the latest Grand Theft Auto is the most profitable media commodity of all time. It's made the most money of any media commodity, so film or music or anything. And it's actually made in Britain. It's made in Scotland. But of course, it's not really made in Scotland. It's made all over the world. You know, there were like over 1,000 developers who contributed to the game. It relies on industrial labor in China to make the consoles and the controllers and all the parts for you to be able to play it. And so I think in a way, like video games as a like, commodity can tell us a lot about how production has changed globally. So we see the kind of, you know, in the UK and Europe and the US, you have these video game developers that we don't often see anything of their work, but it still relies very much on factory labor elsewhere in the world. And the working conditions, I think, on the whole, are pretty hidden. So the book started with an article that I wrote in 2014. Because I had a friend who worked in the video games industry, and I did, you know, I was talking to him about working conditions, and he was saying they can work huge hours in the run up to a launch, because a company, if they're investing $10 million in a game, they want it to be ready on the date that they want it ready for, because they spend so much on marketing. Hey,
this is a crunch time thing you talk about, is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. So, in a sense, it's a kind of classical problem of work. You know, when Marx was writing about the factory acts during industrialization, he talks about people's working day being lengthened. And this is what happens for many video game developers. They are expected to work double, triple hours or so on, because there's value in their labor. And it's better to make them work really, really hard than employ another 1,000 developers.
Yeah. Yeah, so it is a very interesting story, because also, and I take some of this from, because I said this to you earlier, I'll say it to the listeners, I haven't read the book yet, although I'm very much looking forward to it. It's one I hope to maybe get into on my week off. You did write an article in The Independent about the violence, gambling techniques, and worker exploitation behind the world's favourite video games, which I do recommend people go and check out. That was 1st of June, wasn't it, this year?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. And you talked about a lot of this sort of stuff in there. The Grand Theft Auto 5 it was. 90 million sales and $6 billion in revenue. Wow.
This is astonishing, hey? It's an astonishing amount of money. And, you know, the thing, the people who work in the video games industry in the UK, at least, you know, they are paid relatively well. But the kinds of issues that they want to talk about are things like the culture of overwork or crunch, but also things like institutional sex. I think there's a kind of similarity with the organizing that tech workers are doing in the US at the moment.
Right.
So the walkout at Google, there was a petition about not wanting to work with the US military that's happened at some of these places. These aren't like the traditional trade union demands of, you know, the specific terms and conditions over a contract, maybe like a pay raise or pensions or holiday or whatever. But they're bigger questions about workers' control. So like, why do the people who spend these huge amounts of time working on video games, why do they not get more of a say in their work? And so they're kind of big questions that many of these workers are trying to deal with at the moment.
In a weird way, and I might be being too grandiose here, so you know, shut me up if I am, but it reminds me a little bit of the way that we celebrate architects or people like that for building incredible monuments, and then completely forget about the people who actually laid the bricks.
Totally. And I think a lot of these workers, you know, there are some people who you know, their job in a video game, you know, there's a kind of one of the big series, Assassin's Creed, there was somebody whose job it was to paint the bird poo on every building in the city. You know, lots of the jobs that people do are really, you know, it's incredible division of labor, because if you're making these huge video games that can take, you know, 50, 100 hours to play through, the actual individual things that the worker does on that game might be really, really small. So, they, you know, they're laying the bricks that they do for the, you know, an architect's grand vision of some statue or whatever. But, you know, so much of that work is hidden. And I think on the flip side, people who work in the video games industry tend to really love video games. So there's a huge passion, you know, they really want to be in the industry. And, you know, whenever there's a huge passion at work, but yeah, so in the video games industry, you know, people who work in video games tend to really love video games. You know, they tend to have a real passion for the industry. And so what that means is if you're really passionate and you really want to work in an industry, there's a huge risk that you'll be exploited, you'll be taken advantage of because of that passion that you have for the work.
Yeah, you know, I can remember when I was a kid and we all had Mega Drives and or Super Nintendo, depending on whichever side you want. And we had a mate from my school who went on to work in the games industry, and it seemed great. It seemed glamorous. You know, he was in some kind of production design or something. But it's worth thinking, you know, because after thinking about this sort of stuff, it makes you think twice a bit when someone says, I'm in the games industry. You might think, oh, and I'm not saying I would think this way, but one might imagine, oh, that sounds like, you know, that's the job you always wanted to do just because you like playing games or whatever. But actually, especially when this kind of money is going down, you're just as open to exploitation and those taking advantage of you and degrading your labor as you are in any other industry, it seems.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think in the tech industry more broadly, there were lots of arguments in at the kind of birth of these industries that you really didn't want trade unions involved. Mm-hmm. And so managers were really trying to understand, like, how do you get rid of trade unions? And for lots of this high-skilled kind of tech work, and you can read about some of this stuff at the time, is they said, pay these workers like they have a union already, and you will end up not having a union. So you'll have ended up paying more, but you won't have to deal with these questions. So there's been a really deliberate attempt to prevent these industries from becoming unionized, which over the past year has been a huge reversal of.
All the Rage with John Bowd on www.traxfm.org.